I wish someone would tell 20-somethings that the office has a completely different culture than what they are used to. You can't start an email with, hey, you're probably going to have to work at one thing for quite a while before being promoted or even complimented. People are going to tell you not to tweet about work or put stupid posts on your GChat status, not to wear certain clothes. You have to think about how you speak and write, how you act. 20-somethings who've never had jobs don't know this. Neither do the scanners and baristas who've been hanging out at work, chatting with their friends. What happens at work every day matters. Typos matter and sick days matter, not just for the worker, but for the company's bottom line. As Danielle said, I didn't worry like this in school because in a way, I knew it didn't mean anything. I wasn't going to fail out, and as long as I made decent grades, I was going to walk away with a diploma just like everyone else. The end point was the same. Now what I do makes a difference for my boss and everyone else here. That's what I lose sleep over. Every day I feel like I'm going to be fired, or I'm going to disappoint someone. They're going to figure out they don't need me, that I don't belong here. Like I've lied on my resume or something, and I'm just pretending to be a grown-up. Then I'll be waiting tables somewhere. Danielle wasn't fired. She was given more responsibility. In college, Danielle had interned at a television station, so when she wasn't chasing down lattes for her boss, she was allowed to produce the small bits of news no one watched. The feature about the cat stuck in a tree in Central Park, or the seasonal story about the 4th of July fireworks. Her friends and family said she was doing well to have such a good job, but Danielle didn't feel so well. She loved the work, the producing, not the lattes, but she had never felt so anxious and incompetent in her life. She called herself the accidental producer. Her confidence was at an all-time low. Danielle was right where she needed to be. 20-somethings who don't feel anxious and incompetent at work are usually overconfident or underemployed. Danielle was interested in producing, and this was her chance. The problem was that, like most 20-somethings, Danielle made mistakes. She sent an email with the wrong tone to a superior. She laid the camera bag over part of a microphone so one of her segments sounded muffled. Sometimes her voice cracked when she spoke in meetings. When these things happened, some senior employee would breeze by in the hallway and almost as an afterthought, let Danielle know about her major screw-up. She would sometimes be called into her boss's office, such as when she misspelled a former president's name on a web headline. We cannot afford to piss off half the country, much less the red half, her boss said gravely. Danielle was describing the everyday micro-traumas that can feel a part of the 20-something work week. She often felt jolted by bad things that happened, and this took a toll. She stopped eating breakfast because she felt too queasy before work. At night, she had trouble falling asleep as she turned over in her mind comments from her boss or anticipated reprimands to come. Walking around at work is like living in London during the Blitz, she said. I'm always thinking, so far, so good, or how many more hours I need to get through before I'm safe for the day. Danielle sounded a lot like the other 20-somethings I know who have good jobs. To understand what it can be like to be a 20-something at work, it helps to know more about how the brain, and the 20-something brain in particular, processes information. Evolutionary theorists believe the brain is designed to pay special attention to what catches us off guard, so we can be better prepared to meet the world next time. The brain even has a built-in novelty detector, a part that sends chemical signals to stimulate memory when new and different things happen. We know from research studies that when people view slides of ordinary objects, such as a house, and bizarre objects, such as a zebra head attached to a car, the viewers are more likely to remember the bizarre. Likewise, when research subjects are startled, such as by the image and sound of a snake, they have better recall for the slides that immediately follow the snake than they do for other slides. Similarly, people are more likely to remember highly emotional events, such as times when they were happy or sad or embarrassed. When something surprising happens, especially if it arouses emotions, we tend to remember it vividly for a long time. These remembrances are called flashbulb memories because they feel illuminated and frozen in time, like our brain has taken a photograph of the moment. That is why most of us remember exactly where we were on the morning of 9/11, just as our parents and grandparents remember what they were doing when they heard President Kennedy had been shot. Because our 20s are when we transition into so many new things, 20-something life is full of new and surprising moments, even flashbulb memories. In fact, multiple studies have shown that more vivid memories come from early adulthood than any other developmental stage. Some of these memories are unusually happy, such as getting a dream job or going on a great first date. Other surprising moments are especially difficult, such as hitting reply all on an email intended for one person, or waiting a miserably long week for the results of an STD test after a night of unprotected sex, or being dumped via text message. In one of the first college classes I taught, I think I was 28, I handed back exams to 300 people without recording the grades. That's a mistake you make only once. Everyone learns things the hard way at some time or another, and our brains take pictures so the learning stays with us. This is the basis for the saying, "That's a lesson you'll never forget." It is a jarring, but efficient and often necessary, way to grow. 20-somethings take these difficult moments particularly hard. Compared to older adults, they find the negative information, the bad news, more memorable than positive information or the good news. MRI studies show that 20-something brains simply react more strongly to negative information than do the brains of older adults. There is more activity in the amygdala, the seat of the emotional brain. When 20-somethings have their competence criticized, they become anxious and angry. They are tempted to march in and take action. They generate negative feelings towards others and obsess about the why. Why did my boss say that? Why doesn't my boss like me? Taking work so intensely personally can make a 40-hour work week long indeed. William James, the father of research psychology in the United States, said, "The art of being wise is knowing what to overlook." Knowing what to overlook is one way that older adults are typically wiser than young adults. With age comes what is known as a positivity effect. We become more interested in positive information, and our brains react less strongly to what negative information we do encounter. We disengage with interpersonal conflict, choosing to let it be, especially when those in our network are involved. I told Danielle how the 20-something brain responds to surprise and criticism, how it makes many 20-somethings feel like, as one colleague says, leaves in the wind. A good day at work lifts us high in the air, while a reprimand from a boss whips us down to the ground. As criticism blows us every which way, we feel, at work and in love, only as good as the last thing that happened. "That's exactly how I feel," Danielle said, "like a leaf. I never realized my boss would have this kind of effect. He's a bigger deal in my life right now than anybody. He's like God. Whatever he says seems like the ultimate judgment about me." As we age, we feel less like leaves and more like trees. We have roots that ground us and sturdy trunks that may sway but don't break in the wind. The wind that blows by can be more serious. "You're fired" is much scarier when you have a mortgage. The things we do wrong at work are no longer typos, but may be losing a $500,000 account or releasing software that crashes the company website for a day. But older adults, and even 20-somethings who work at it, can be rooted in the confidence that problems can be solved or at least survived. Sometimes my clients ask whether I ever lose sleep over work. Of course I do. Just last year, I threw on a pair of jeans at midnight and sped to the emergency room after a client attempted suicide. I beat the ambulance there, and as I stood in the wind in the hospital drive, and my client's parents waited 1,000 miles away for me to call with news, I was clear about one thing. As long as this young woman was alive, anything else could be gotten through. Getting through moments that are surprisingly hurtful or scary or sad was something that this client, who so fortunately did live, could not see for herself at that moment. Danielle resisted quitting one week at a time. "I want to quit when I feel overwhelmed, like I have all this stuff that keeps coming and I keep getting it wrong," she said. Like I'll have to work forever for these same people who see me as such a baby. It's like my back is up against the wall. I can't go home early or mess up when I'm here. I feel like I'm trapped forever with these awful feelings of anxiety and doubt. It's fight or flight all the time. 20-somethings and their active amygdalae often want to change their feelings by changing their jobs. They quit work that becomes messy or unpleasant, or they storm in and complain to their boss's bosses, not realizing that their boss's boss's amygdalae are unlikely to be as worked up as their own. If Danielle left her job, she would feel better for a time, but quitting would also only confirm her fear that she was a poser who didn't belong in a good job anyway. Danielle made up her mind to stay with her boss for at least 1 year, and she shifted to a different, also problematic strategy. She started worrying all the time. Our sessions overflowed with errors she made, reasons she could be fired, or ways work could go wrong. Many days she wandered the side streets during her lunch break and cried about the same things on the phone to her parents and her friends, only to turn around and head back into the building for more. Danielle knew these worries didn't actually prevent problems, but continuously imagining the worst did protect her from being caught off guard when something did go wrong. "I'll do anything not to feel that awful blitz feeling," she said. Danielle's worries kept her from feeling surprised, but they did so by keeping her body in a chronically negatively aroused state. Sustained worrying drives the heart rate up. It raises levels of cortisol, or stress hormone. It leads to depressed thoughts. Danielle said, "I think I've regressed. This is like when I had my first serious boyfriend in college, and I constantly worried he was going to break up with me because he hated my outfit or something. I was always turning over in my mind everything he said, and talking to all my girlfriends about it all the time. I had 3 or 4 friends on speed dial, and we talked about it all the time. Do you know why it feels the same? Because I'm dating my job and it's an abusive relationship? No, I laughed, because it is the same. I have these same conversations with other 20-something clients about their relationships. These clients worry incessantly about being dropped over some small thing, or they get anxious when a few hours go by without an incoming text. Like you've been tempted to quit your job, they are tempted to break up or pick a fight to force some kind of closure so they don't get caught by surprise. I could not handle dating on top of all of this. What do you tell them?" "The same thing I'm telling you. You have to get some roots and stand in the wind." "So I just stuff all of my bad feelings and pretend they aren't happening?" "No, stuffing your feelings, that's not a root. That's no better than chronic worrying.
Suppressing your feelings keeps your body and brain stressed, and it impairs your memory.
It will leave you in sort of a fog." "Then how do I calm down?" Danielle said she felt trapped at work and trapped by her feelings of anxiety and doubt. This didn't have to be the case. Psychiatrist and Holocaust survivor Viktor Frankl describes our attitudes and reactions as being the last of our human freedoms. Danielle may not have had control over every situation at work, but she could control how she interpreted them and how she reacted to them. She could get out of her amygdala and put her frontal lobe to work. Danielle needed to reappraise the meaning of her difficult moments. When things went wrong on the job, Danielle immediately feared being fired and having to wait tables. This wasn't rational. Jobs and relationships usually aren't that fragile. Even if she did lose her job, I wasn't sure why she would be waiting tables as a result. Danielle needed to understand that tough days were just winds blowing by, and that work was not as personal as she imagined it to be. Reappraising lessens and even prevents bad feelings. If Danielle could reevaluate situations based on the facts, it would change not only how she dealt with work, but also how she felt about it. Research shows that people who have some control over their emotions report greater life satisfaction, optimism, purpose, and better relationships with others. "Right now, you're spending a lot of time hyping the emotions," I said, "to yourself and to other people on the phone. You're magnifying and catastrophizing every misstep. You've got to quit calling your mother on your lunch breaks." "But calling my mom makes me feel better." "I know it does, but those phone calls are robbing you of the opportunity to calm yourself down." When Danielle called her mother, she was doing what psychologists call borrowing an ego. She was reaching out in a moment of need and letting someone else's frontal lobe do the work. We all need to do that sometimes, but if we externalize our distress too much, we don't learn to handle bad days on our own. We don't practice soothing ourselves just when our brains are in the best position to pick up new skills. We don't learn how to calm ourselves down, and this in and of itself undermines confidence. What if you got yourself through your lunch hour? I proposed to Danielle. I don't know how. Yes, you do. We've worked on this. You hang up the phone and you handle things.
I handle things.
Yes. When something difficult happens at work, you can answer your emotional brain with reason. You think, what about the facts? The facts are that I look around at everybody else and I see I suck at my job. Danielle moped. Maybe I don't have what it takes. And so my own phone calls with Danielle continued. Outside in. Inaction breeds fear and doubt. Action breeds confidence and courage. If you want to conquer fear, do not sit home and think about it. Go out and get busy. Dale Carnegie, writer and lecturer. Knowledge is not skill. Knowledge plus 10,000 times is skill. Shinichi Suzuki, founder of the Suzuki Method for Music Instruction. Maybe you don't have what it takes, I repeated to Danielle. What does that even mean? In television, you always hear about people have it. One day I asked my boss if he thought I had it, and you know what he said? He said, no, you don't have it, but if you work hard, you could. How did you interpret that, I asked. It sort of made me feel good, like I wasn't doing all this for nothing, but it also made me feel second rate, like I'm not a natural in his eyes. A natural, I said back. Yeah. What's it, anyway? What do you imagine everybody else just has that you don't, I asked.
Confidence, Danielle answered simply.
Why would you have confidence, I asked. You just started your career. Danielle looked at some of her coworkers and was just sure they were born with self-assurance, or at least graduated with it, when in fact, most of the people she compared herself to were older than she was, or had been working longer than she had. She imagined that people at work either had confidence or they didn't, so any little thing that went wrong on the job suggested she didn't. Her mistakes became statements about who she was, perhaps a person not assured enough for a career in television, and not just feedback about what she needed to learn, or a reflection of where she was in her career. The beginning. She feared every reprimand indicated she was not a natural, and this left her devastated. It sometimes made quitting seem like her only option. Danielle's idea that people were innately confident on the job, or they weren't, is called a fixed mindset. We can have fixed mindsets about different things, intelligence, athletic ability, social savvy, thinness. But whatever the case, a fixed mindset is a way of thinking in black and white. When it came to confidence, Danielle thought there were haves and have-nots, and maybe she was a have-not. She feared her more self-possessed co-workers were cut out for the work, when she obviously wasn't. This made work a scary place. Big mistakes or negative comments felt like verdicts. Those who use what is called a growth mindset believe that people can change, that success is something to be achieved. Maybe it's not the case that any person can be anything, but it is still true that within certain parameters, people can learn and grow. For those who have a growth mindset, failures may sting, but they are also viewed as opportunities for improvement and change. Decades of research in schools tells us that a fixed mindset gets in the way of success. School kids with fixed mindsets enjoy work that affirms their belief that they have it, whether the it is science smarts or talent on the basketball court. But once the work becomes challenging, these same kids stop enjoying school. They feel threatened by hard work, fearing it means they don't have it after all. Struggle means being a have-not. Consider this. In a longitudinal study of college students, freshmen were evaluated for fixed mindsets or growth mindsets and then followed across their 4 years of enrollment. When the students with fixed mindsets encountered academic challenges such as daunting projects or low grades, they gave up, while the students with growth mindsets responded by working harder or trying new strategies. Rather than strengthening their skills and toughening their resolve, 4 years of college left the students with fixed mindsets feeling less confident. The feelings they most associated with school were distress, shame, and upset. Those with growth mindsets performed better in school overall, and at graduation time they reported feeling confident, determined, enthusiastic, inspired, and strong. As it goes for students, 20-something's theories about success and confidence can have a profound effect on their performance on the job. Danielle was a hard worker who'd clearly had a growth mindset when she was in college. That's how she wound up in her high-profile job. But somehow, Danielle had the wrong ideas about work. While some research suggests that individuals strongly either hold a fixed mindset or a growth one when it comes to qualities such as intelligence, to assume that Danielle was a have-not when it came to a growth mindset would be premature. I suspected Danielle believed that people at work either had what it took or they didn't, not because she had a permanently fixed mindset about confidence, but because she didn't understand the workplace. If Danielle learned more about where on-the-job confidence actually came from, how she saw herself could change. Confidence doesn't come from the inside out. It moves from the outside in. People feel less anxious and more confident on the inside when they can point to things they have done well on the outside. Fake confidence comes from stuffing our self-doubt. Empty confidence comes from parental platitudes on our lunch hour. Real confidence comes from mastery experiences, which are actual lived moments of success, especially when things seem difficult. Whether we are talking about love or work, the confidence that overrides insecurity comes from experience. There is no other way. It is not uncommon for 20-something clients to come to therapy hoping I can help them increase their confidence. Some wonder if maybe I do hypnosis, and a hypnotherapy session might do the trick. I don't, and it wouldn't. Or they hope I can recommend some herbal remedy. I can't. The way I help 20-somethings gain confidence is by sending them back to work or back to their relationships with some better information. I teach them about how they can have more mastery over their emotions. I talk to them about what confidence really is. Literally, confidence means with trust. In research psychology, the more precise term is self-efficacy, or one's ability to be effective or produce the desired result. No matter what word you use, confidence is trusting yourself to get the job done, whether that job is public speaking, sales, teaching, or being an assistant. And that trust only comes from having gotten the job done many times before. As was the case for every other 20-something I'd worked with, Danielle's confidence on the job could only come from doing well on the job, but not all the time. Sometimes Danielle fantasized about waiting tables or working in some easy job where she didn't have to think or didn't make mistakes. But 20-somethings who hide out in underemployment, especially those who are hiding out because of a lack of confidence, are not serving themselves. For work success to lead to confidence, the job has to be challenging and it must require effort. It has to be done without too much help, and it cannot go well every single day. A long run of easy successes creates a sort of fragile confidence, the kind that is shattered when the first failure comes along. A more resilient confidence comes from succeeding and from surviving some failures. I spend most of my days at work managing how I feel, Danielle complained. Sometimes it's all I can do not to lash out at someone. It's all I can do just to stay in the building for the whole day. That's a mastery experience. Mastering your emotions at work builds confidence. Then you can hang around long enough to have other successes at work. It's going to take time. You need more mastery experiences. Like how many more exactly? Danielle asked. There is no magic number, I said. Can you give me an estimate? She continued, only partially kidding. Okay, about 10,000 hours worth. Ugh, Danielle shouted into the phone. Where did you get that? I told Danielle about the work of K. Anders Ericsson, a research psychologist who is probably the expert on, well, expertise. In years of study, he and his colleagues have looked at surgeons, pianists, writers, investors, dart players, violinists, and other types of talent. They have found that a large part of what makes people good and even great at what they do is time in. For the most part, naturals are myths. People who are especially good at something may have some innate inclination or some particular talent, but they have also spent about 10,000 hours practicing or doing that thing. Not everyone wants to be a virtuoso, but most 20-somethings I know want to be exceptionally good at what they choose to do. In most cases, it is going to take at least 10,000 hours of their time. Sometimes it seems that the challenge of the 20-something years is to figure out what to do, and then suddenly it will just start happening. We imagine we will show up at work and instantly add value or be taken seriously. This is not the case. Knowing you want to do something isn't the same as knowing how to do it. And even knowing how to do something isn't the same as actually doing it well. The real challenge of the 20-something years is the work itself. 10,000 hours is 5 years of focused full-time work. 40 hours times 50 work weeks a year equals 2,000 hours a year times 5 years equals 10,000 hours. Or 10,000 hours is 10 years of less targeted work. 20 hours times 50 work weeks a year equals 1,000 hours a year times 10 years equals 10,000 hours. My 10,000 hours were 7 years of graduate school. Danielle's 10,000 hours were going to be 5 to 10 years of working her way up and around and producing. That's why she needed to dig in now. "Oh my God," Danielle said. "I don't think I can work for my crazy boss for 5 years, for 10,000 hours. It may not all be at the same job. Besides, you're not at zero." Danielle was giving away some of her confidence by not recognizing the successes she had already earned. She'd been performing well at a difficult job for 6 months, so she had done about 1,000 hours so far. She also had hundreds of hours of experience from previous internships. It was time to take stock of what she had. She made a list of the relevant things she'd mastered in school and at work. She hung up her diploma in her apartment. She started taking herself seriously by dressing more professionally. She stopped calling her parents and her friends on her lunch hour so she could give herself credit for getting through the day. She cleaned up the way she talked about herself on the job. "No more self-deprecating stories," she declared. Danielle had been avoiding feedback at work because she felt almost terrorized by comments that had come her way. This was not working in her favor. Without concrete information, Danielle was too quick to assume the worst. Positive feedback would give her the opportunity to feel better, and negative feedback would give her the chance to do better. Danielle made it through her first year on the job. After much urging during our Monday morning sessions, she requested a 1-year performance review at work. Her typically harried and unforgiving boss slowed down long enough to read the paperwork aloud. He had written that Danielle was the best assistant he'd had in a long time, a hard worker who came in on Saturdays to produce her own stories, a go-getter and a calm problem solver. "Ha," she said about that last one. Danielle received a $1,000 year-end bonus and decided that the bonus was worth an extra 1,000 hours toward the total 10,000 hours. "Fair enough," I said. With every week, work was a bit less dramatic. When things went wrong, which they still did all the time, Danielle didn't feel as judged. She realized that there was a difference between having a feeling and acting on it. Now, when she felt anxious or incompetent, she calmed herself with what had gone well. Around this time, my phone sessions with Danielle stopped being about quitting her job. Her amygdala was quieting down, her frontal lobe was working hard. She handled new problems with less emotion and more reason. By our estimate, Danielle had about 6,000 hours to go before she would probably feel confident at work. She still worried on Sunday nights when faced with another week, but her boss seemed less awful, and Danielle knew she should stay at her job at least until she found something better. A year or so later, she received an email from another assistant across town. "There's an awesome job over here with the president of production. You should jump on this because you'd get to produce all the time. There's no one here we like for it, so we will definitely be posting the job. Get in here before that. P.S. The guy you'd work for is nice." Danielle got the new job and faced quitting her old one, Looks like I'm going to be working toward my 10,000 hours elsewhere.
Terrific, I said.
So what are we going to talk about now, she asked.
What about relationships? Last year you said you couldn't handle dating.
Oi, said Danielle quickly. I want a relationship in theory, but I still cannot imagine having the time to meet anybody, much less figuring out how to be in a relationship.
Can I deal with that way, way later?
A little bit later, I said. You can go to work and be in love at the same time, you know. In fact, it would be good for you.
Getting along and getting ahead. Life itself still remains a very effective therapist. Karen Horney, psychoanalyst. Love and work are the cornerstones of our humanness. Sigmund Freud, neurologist and founder of psychoanalysis. For many years, there has been a spirited debate among personality researchers about whether people change after age 30. Numerous studies have shown that, relatively speaking, we don't. After 30, our thoughts and feelings and behaviors remain incredibly stable. Those who are relatively extroverted keep being relatively extroverted, and those who are conscientious keep being conscientious. But there is still some disagreement about exactly how much people don't change. One side says, barring interventions or catastrophic events, personality traits appear to be essentially fixed after age 30. The other side is more optimistic, holding out for some change, albeit small in magnitude. Whether after 30 we can expect to change a bit or not at all, what all sides of the post-30 debate have recently come to agree on is something that many clinicians have known all along. Our personalities change more during the 20-something years than at any time before or after. This is big news because conventional wisdom tells us that childhood or adolescence is when our personalities are on the move. There's the Jesuit maxim, give me the child until he is 7 and I'll give you the man. Freud's theory of personality development ended at puberty. And in the media, adolescence is portrayed as our one opportunity to try being someone new. We now know that of any time in life, our 20s are our best chance for change. I have seen 20-somethings move from socially anxious to socially confident enough, or get beyond years of childhood unhappiness in a relatively short period of time. And because these changes are happening just as long-term careers and relationships are being decided, these same shifts can lead to very different lives. The 20s are a time when people and personalities are poised for transformation. I once supervised a psychology graduate student who told me she disliked working with 20-somethings. She said when she worked with older adults in therapy, she felt like a medical examiner, like her job was to figure out what had gone wrong in people's lives and to bring closure. She imagined she was investigating a death of sorts, finding problems that led to divorce or career failure or some other personal demise. When she worked with 20-somethings, this graduate student said she felt more pressure. She worried she might make them better or worse. She said she felt like there was more on the table. This student may not have fully understood therapy with older adults, but she was right about one thing. The 20-something years are no time for a post-mortem. Life isn't over. It is not too late. Sam found out over a bowl of Cheerios that his parents were divorcing. On that particular Saturday morning, he was 12 years old, and it was 2 weeks before the 7th grade would begin. Sam's mother told him she'd bought a house down the street. Life would go on the same as before, only in 2 homes, she promised. She cheerily recruited Sam to help her move out, and to a kid his age, carting boxes to a new place seemed exciting and neat. Now with great insight, he said, my mom let me be too helpful. She let me enjoy it too much. Sam felt conned. Each of Sam's parents wanted to be part of his day-to-day life, so when the school year began, he switched houses every day. In the morning, he packed the clothes and books he thought he would need for that day and part of the next. He'd wake up the next morning and do it all again. For the next 6 years, the only constant was worrying about what he had left behind or feeling mad about what he was hauling around. To Sam, the every-other-night shit had been in his parents' best interests, not his own. It had been a way for Sam's parents to deny that their lives were changing
and that everyone was going to miss out, most of all Sam. After many sessions spent talking about Sam's parents' divorce, I started to feel stressed. I noticed I sometimes wanted to say, "Move on!" This was an unsympathetic urge, especially because what Sam had to say was important. Upon giving it some thought, I realized the impulse probably came from my not knowing much about Sam's current life. Sam had come to therapy because ever since his parents' divorce, he'd felt anxious and angry. Eventually, he was going to expect to feel better, and I knew talking about the past was only going to get us so far. I made a conscious effort to direct our attention to Sam's present, which I found was not going well. Every time I'd seen Sam, he had a backpack. I now learned the backpack usually had clothes and maybe a toothbrush in it, because Sam never knew when he would make it home or where exactly home was. Sam said he lived in about 5 different places. Technically, he resided with his mother and stepfather, but he often crashed at friends' apartments, especially if, after a late night out, it was easier to stay on that side of town. Sam's resume was as scattered as the various places he slept. He'd changed jobs nearly every year since college. Currently, he was fun employed, which meant he was supposed to be enjoying himself and riding out unemployment benefits, but life was becoming less and less fun. He bemoaned living life at loose ends. He no longer enjoyed going out like he used to. He so anxiously anticipated the question of "what do you do?" that he'd taken to having a couple of shots of liquor before leaving the house on Friday or Saturday nights. Whenever the conversations at parties turned to jobs, Sam felt self-conscious, and he headed off to get a stronger drink. "It's weird," Sam said. "The older I get, the less I feel like a man." "I'm not sure you're giving yourself much to feel like a man about," I offered. From what I could see, Sam still lived like a vagrant. Switching jobs and houses, he was keeping on with the every other night shit of his childhood in a 20-something way. No wonder he was anxious and angry. No wonder he didn't feel like a man. I told Sam I was glad he'd come to therapy. It made sense for us to spend some time talking about his parents' split and about how this led to living life out of a backpack. I also told him he didn't have to live life out of a backpack anymore. In fact, as long as he kept it up, he was going to keep feeling the same. "Things are totally hopeless. I can't change," Sam said to me one day as he leaned over, elbows on his knees and rubbing his head all over like he'd come straight from getting a really short haircut. "I need a brain transplant." "Your brain does get used to doing things a certain way, but I don't feel hopeless about you at all. I feel quite hopeful." "Why?" he asked, with a sort of helpless sarcasm that captured the anger and anxiety he'd described. "Because you're in your 20s. Your brain can change. Your personality can change." "How?" he wondered aloud, this time with a touch more curiosity than cynicism. "That brain transplant you want, it's going to come from a life transplant. By joining the world, you could feel a lot better." Sam and I talked about a Pew Research Center study showing that, contrary to what movies and blogs may lead us to believe, employed 20-somethings are happier than unemployed 20-somethings. I suggested that in addition to therapy, Sam get a job, and while he was at it, a regular place to sleep. The cynicism quickly returned, with Sam saying some boring job would only make him feel worse. Being responsible for an apartment would just add to the things he was always forgetting to do. A steady job and a place to take care of were the last things he needed, he said. Sam was wrong. Numerous studies from around the world show that life starts to feel better across the 20-something years. We become more emotionally stable and less tossed around by life's ups and downs. We become more conscientious and responsible. We become more socially competent. We feel more agreeable about life and more able to cooperate with others. Overall, we become happier and more confident and less, as Sam put it, anxious and angry. But these sorts of changes don't happen for everyone. Sam couldn't keep walking around with his backpack, waiting to feel better. In our 20s, positive personality changes come from what researchers call getting along and getting ahead. Feeling better doesn't come from avoiding adulthood, it comes from investing in adulthood. These are the years when we move from school to work, from hookups to relationships, or in Sam's case, from couches to apartments. Most of these changes are about making adult commitments to bosses, partners, leases, roommates, and these commitments shift how we are in the world and who we are inside. The investments we make in work and love trigger personality maturation. Being a cooperative colleague or a successful partner is what drives personality change. Settling down simply helps us feel more settled. 20-somethings who don't feel like they are getting along or getting ahead, on the other hand, feel stressed and angry and alienated, like Sam. There are all sorts of ways to make commitments to the world around us, and sometimes in our 20s, we have to be forgiving about what being settled or successful means. A great relationship or a job to be proud of may seem elusive, but just working toward these things makes us happier. 20-somethings who experience even some workplace success or financial security are more confident, positive, and responsible than those who do not. Even simply having goals can make us happier and more confident, both now and later. In one study that followed nearly 500 young adults from college to the mid-30s, increased goal setting in the 20s led to greater purpose, mastery, agency, and well-being in the 30s. Goals are how we declare who we are and who we want to be. They are how we structure our years and our lives. Goals have been called the building blocks of adult personality, and it is worth considering that who you will be in your 30s and beyond is being built out of the goals you are setting for yourself today. Outside of work, commitments to others also foster change and well-being. Studies in the United States and Europe have found that entering into stable relationships helps 20-somethings feel more secure and responsible, whether these relationships last or not. Steady relationships reduce social anxiety and depression, as they help us feel less lonely and give us the opportunity to practice our interpersonal skills. We learn about managing our emotions and about conflict resolution. As we take part in partnering, we find new ways to feel competent in the adult world. And on the days we do feel bad about our 20s, these relationships can be a source of security and a more mature safe haven than what we have with our parents. Being single while you're young may be glorified in the press, but staying single across the 20s does not typically feel good. A study that tracked men and women from their early 20s to their later 20s found that of those who remained single, who dated or hooked up but avoided commitments, 80% were dissatisfied with their dating lives, and only 10% didn't wish they had a partner. Being chronically uncoupled may be especially detrimental to men, as those who remain single throughout their 20s experienced a significant dip in their self-esteem near 30. Sam had it all backward. The way he saw it, he couldn't join the world until he felt like a man, but he wasn't going to feel like a man until he joined the world. Sam imagined that the real world would just add to his problems, but if he wanted to feel less anxious and angry in his 20s or his 30s, setting goals and making commitments was the proven way to go. Sam started to look for an apartment. At first, he would only commit to a series of short sublets. He felt calmer for months at a time, but then the backpack would reappear. Sam didn't see any good reason to have an apartment until he realized what he most wanted was a dog. He felt almost too ashamed to tell me he'd once had a dog before his parents divorced. After the split, it became unclear who was supposed to be taking care of the dog. The dog stopped being attended to and started having behavior problems, like chewing through rugs or growling at people. Before long, the dog was given away. Sam blamed himself for not having done better by his dog. I tried to reassure Sam that what happened to his dog and to him was his parents' failing, not his own. I could see that talking about it was almost unbearable for him. When Sam got an apartment and a dog, he came to life. Caring for the dog and walking the dog gave Sam the rhythm and meaning that had been missing for years. He would tell funny stories about his dog and show me pictures. I could almost see his personality and his life shifting from across the room. Sam started walking dogs for money. He worked as an assistant to an obedience coach. He soon saved up enough to start his own small business, a canine daycare called Dog Days. This was, Sam said, his chance to do it differently. Not long after Dog Days got going, Sam stopped therapy. It was difficult for him to meet regularly because he needed to be at work. A couple of years later, Sam emailed to say that he felt happier and more confident. He was in the same apartment. He was renting a big warehouse space for Dog Days and had a business plan that included expanding into another space on the other side of town. He was in a serious relationship and was volunteering as a puppy raiser for guide dogs. Sam said he wasn't ready for marriage yet, but he'd been thinking more about being a parent. He'd been mad at his own parents for so long, and he'd let them take care of him for so long, he had forgotten to notice that caring for someone or something was a real strength of his own. He was good at it, and it made him feel good in return. Being a dad was something he knew he didn't want to miss. Everybody. The management of fertility is one of the most important functions of adulthood. Germaine Greer, feminist theorist. There was a fair amount of media buzz when Demi Moore, age 47, said she wanted to have a baby with her then-husband, Ashton Kutcher, age 32. In a May 2010 interview with UK Elle magazine, Ms. Moore said, "We talk about it, and it's something we would like. He's an amazing father to my daughters already, so I have no doubt that if it's in our future, it would be an incredible part of our journey together." From the article, it's not clear whether Ms. Moore meant that the couple wanted to adopt or use an egg donor or have a baby the old-fashioned way, but the headlines flew. Demi Moore wants to have a baby with Ashton Kutcher. Demi Moore and Ashton Kutcher hope for a baby. Ashton Kutcher talks biological babies with Demi Moore. These headlines troubled me. I envisioned young women everywhere imagining that Ms. Moore was pushing the boundaries for their biological clocks, just as she has for how great women can look after 40. Unfortunately, it is not that simple. As the average life expectancy increases and young adults marry later and spend more time on education and work, more couples are having their first child in their 30s and even 40s. The 2010 report by the Pew Research Center titled "The New Demography of American Motherhood" shows that today's mother is older and more educated than the mothers of the past. Babies born to mothers over 35 now outnumber those born to teen moms, and the average age for first-time motherhood is 25, with about one-third of first-time moms over 30. The number of women who opt for childbearing between the ages of 35 and 39 has increased by nearly 50% in the last 20 years, and by 80% for women aged 40 to 44. For many, it just isn't feasible to have children before work and love are figured out. And research consistently shows that educated moms are on the rise and good for kids. And for the first time in history, women outnumber men in the workplace, which means that more women and men are balancing work and family. None of this has changed the way our bodies work. It has just changed how much we need to know about fertility. Fertility might sound like a topic for a 30-something or 40-something book, but it's not. In a different Pew survey, when 20-somethings were asked to identify their top priorities, the majority, 52%, named being a good parent as one of the most important goals in life. Next in line was having a successful marriage at 30%. Compare this to the 15% who prioritized a high-paying career, the 9% who most valued free time, and the 1% who hoped to become famous. These numbers tell us that what many 20-somethings most want is to have happy families, at least eventually. These 20-somethings have a right to know that the years just ahead are their most fertile. They deserve to be educated about fertility statistics before they themselves are the statistics. What is about to follow are some sobering statistics about having babies after the age of 35. Medicine has been called a science of uncertainty and an art of probability, and this holds especially true for reproductive medicine. It is an imperfect science, so not all pre-35 women will easily have the babies they want, nor is it true that those over 35 will not. But there are some age-related changes that everyone who wants children would be better off understanding. Most of these changes are about female fertility, because this is something scientists know a lot about. Still, a biological clock ticks in both women and men. researchers are beginning to find that older sperm may be associated with various neurocognitive problems in children, including autism, schizophrenia, dyslexia, and lower intelligence. For this reason, and for reasons we will discuss further into the chapter, both men and women ought to be thinking about the timing of babies. To be transparent, I had both of my children in my 30s, at 35 and 37 to be exact. Like many 20-somethings, I wanted to establish my career before I had kids, and I did. I waddled across the stage to collect my PhD diploma while 8 months pregnant with baby number one. Before baby number two, I had a private practice and a university job. I've learned a lot about fertility since then, mine, my clients, and women's in general. Having two babies after 35 did not go quite as smoothly as I expected, and now I see how lucky I was. Many women are not as fortunate, women like Caitlin. Caitlin was 34 when she met Ben. They'd been dating for 2 years when she came to my office to talk about transitioning to marriage. Marriage, a first for each, was definitely in the future. Caitlin talked about a wedding a lot, but never mentioned children. I was tempted to assume she did not want them. I decided to ask instead. "What about kids?" I queried. Caitlin seemed taken aback. "I don't know. I haven't decided that yet." Her response made me annoyed. Not at Caitlin, but at a culture that has told women that the decision about whether to have a baby is something that even at 36 is not pressing. I thought about a recent article I'd read in which a woman talked about feeling misled into thinking she would succeed at pregnancy as long as she got started by the time she was 38 or 40. Caitlin seemed to think that too. "Then now is the time to decide," I said. "You don't want to figure out children are important to you just when you can no longer have them." "What good would it do right now? I'm not even married." "You could be, easily. Or you could have a baby first. Getting married is a cinch, but having kids may not be." "But I want the big wedding that all my friends got to have. I want the dress and the pictures. Do you know how many weddings I've been to? Stag? How many presents I've bought? I'm guessing we won't be through an engagement and a wedding for at least a couple of years. Then it would be nice to have a couple of years together without kids first." "All those things would be nice. I know marriage has been a long time coming, and a big wedding would be really special. I still want you to make sure a child isn't something you might want to prioritize even more." Now Caitlin seemed annoyed with me. "People have kids in their 40s," she said. "It is way more common than it used to be. I have 2 40-year-old friends who just had babies. People in Hollywood do it all the time." "More women do than in the past, that's true," I said. "But so many women can't. We do hear about this or that Hollywood 40-something woman who is having a baby. But if you look a bit closer, you'll often find out about the half-dozen fertility treatments that went into it. Or you see the statistics about the everyday 40-something women who wanted to have kids but couldn't. That doesn't make the headlines." Caitlin was relying on a reasoning error known as the availability heuristic. The availability heuristic is a mental shortcut whereby we decide how likely something is based on how easy it is to bring an example to mind. Caitlin was right that it is more common than it used to be for older women to have babies. She personally knew 2 40-year-old women who had succeeded, and she could think of lots of famous women who had as well. But she did not know the statistics about how easy it is and is not to have kids as we approach our 40s. Caitlin didn't know the facts. Fertility, or the ability to reproduce, peaks for women during the late 20-something years. Biologically speaking, the 20s will be the easiest time to have a baby for most women. Some declines in fertility began at about 30, and at 35, a woman's ability to become pregnant and carry a baby to term drops considerably. At 40, fertility plummets. This is because of 2 age-related changes that every woman can expect across her 30s and 40s. Egg quality decreases, and the endocrine system, which regulates hormones and tells the body how to proceed with a pregnancy, becomes less effective. With these changes, pregnancy becomes less likely, and miscarriage becomes more likely. Lower quality eggs have trouble implanting and maturing. Even good eggs can be derailed by hormones gone awry. Compared to their 20-something selves, women are about half as fertile at 30 and about one-quarter as fertile at 35, and about one-eighth as fertile at 40. That's one reason why, if we look at the actual base rates for babies born in the United States in 2007, about 1 million babies were born to mothers aged 20 to 24, another million were born to mothers aged 25 to 29, just under 1 million were born to mothers aged 30 to 34, about 500,000 babies were born to mothers aged 35 to 39, only about 100,000 were born to mothers aged 40 to 44, and fewer than 10,000 were born to women 45 and over. Caitlin's big wedding came and went, and at 38 she began to try to get pregnant. It did not go well. After a year of trying and two miscarriages, she and her husband were referred to a fertility specialist. Caitlin was sure that with the proper treatment, she would have a baby soon. The first signs of decreased fertility are difficulty becoming and staying pregnant. Trying au naturel, just having sex around the time of ovulation, a woman has about a 20 to 25% chance of conceiving during each cycle, up to about age 35. So when you're young, it takes, on average, about 4 or 5 months of having sex to get pregnant. After 35, the per-cycle odds of pregnancy start to drop sharply, down to 5% at 40, then 3% at 41, and 2% at 42. At 40, that's an average of 20 or more months of trying, and the longer we have to spend trying, the worse our odds become. Add to this the rising rates of miscarriage in women over 35. One quarter of pregnancies after 35 and half of pregnancies after 40 miscarry. And the post-35 years can be a time of anticipation and heartbreak for couples like Caitlin and Ben. When couples try to get pregnant but can't, many like Caitlin and Ben turn to fertility treatments, hoping for a remedy. Sometimes it works, and that we hear about. More often it does not, and that we may not hear about. One indicator of how difficult it can be to have a baby as we age is the cost. The average cost of a fertility intervention for a 20-something couple is $25,000. By 35, the cost is about $35,000. After age 35, as the obstacles to pregnancy increase, so does the price tag. At 40, couples who need fertility treatments will pay an average of $100,000 for one live birth. By age 42, the average cost goes up to about $300,000 for a baby. Even if money isn't an obstacle, nature may still be. Fertility treatments fail more than they succeed. Past age 35, intrauterine insemination, or the turkey baster method, in which sperm is inserted into the female reproductive tract, has a 90 to 95% failure rate. In vitro fertilization, IVF, or in vitro, when sperm and egg are united outside the body and implanted in the uterus, succeeds only about 10 to 20% of the time. In older women, the failure rate for these procedures is so high, many fertility clinics will not perform them on 40-something women at all. The failed attempts bring down the success rates the clinics are able to advertise. Sadly, Caitlin and Ben never had a baby. Caitlin tried intrauterine insemination, a few rounds of IVF, and hormone treatments, but none were successful. By 43, clinics were no longer willing to treat her. Doctors suggested egg donation or adoption, but for the time being, Ben and Caitlin felt too physically and financially exhausted to go forward. After working with Caitlin as she scoured the internet, first for wedding venues and then for a way to have a baby, our sessions were now about grief. In 1970, 1 in 10 40-something women were childless. Today, 1 in 5 are. It's true that more women and men are childless by choice. Being a parent is nothing to be idealized. As meaningful as it can be, it is also unrelenting hard work. It can be an emotional stretch. So some couples opt out of parenthood in order to focus on work or other pursuits. But according to a national survey of family growth, about half of childless couples are not childless by choice. They are like Caitlin and Ben. They are 30-something or 40-something women and men who feel they did not consider the facts about fertility soon enough, like maybe when they were 20-somethings who, even if they weren't ready to have children, could have planned work and family trajectories with different outcomes. Fertility may seem like a women's issue, but as more couples have their first child in their 30s and 40s, timing affects everybody. Not included in the statistics above are the countless men and women, straight and gay, who did have children in their 30s and 40s, but who were surprised by how difficult the process turned out to be. What fertility specialists don't hear about, and psychologists do,